This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Everybody, and welcome to Fruit Loops Season 2, Episode 20. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we do not hear or know much about. Now, contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are white. Dudes, what? There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com, or you can leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it on a future episode. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. Or if you can't help monetarily, no big deal. You can always give us a 5-star review on iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcast from. And again, be sure to share this show with your friends. So, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about the DC Snipers, who are John Allen Muhammad, aged 41 at the time, and Lee Boyd Malvo, aged 17 at the time. Their crime spree began in February 2002 and included murders and robberies in the states of Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, and Washington. In 10 months, the snipers killed 17 people and wounded 10 others. And this topic was suggested by Maggie and Rico on Facebook, and also our boy Big Slim 22 on Instagram.
Hey, hip hop air horns to you guys. This was a good suggestion. So we wanted to mention that we believe that in order to do this subject justice, we have to break this into two parts. So we'll record part one this week and then part two next week. Also, there are so many crimes and so many details in this case. So we also want to stick to the meat and potatoes without boring the shit out of you. So we will not cover every single tiny detail. We just don't think it's fair to you. But if you're listening to this and you think there's anything important that you feel we left out, you know where to find us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how you doing?
Oh, well, this week has been kind of depressing. Uh-oh. What with the college admissions bribery scandal and the shooting in New Zealand, neither of which surprised me, unfortunately, which is probably why it's so depressing.
Oh, boy.
But The Good Fight is back on CBS All Access with their third season. So that's good. And I'm looking forward to Game of Thrones coming back next month.
Yes, Lord. Oh,
with their
yes.
last season. So I've been rewatching season 6 and 7 to refresh my memory. And
same.
I just love the parts with the dragons.
Oh my God. Me too. Me too.
I
yes.
need me a dragon.
How wonderful would it be to wreak havoc on all those who are out here committing some fuckery, who couldn't
just
who deserve some
fire
some.
On them.
Yes. Yes.
Dracarys. Yes.
You know what? And speaking of other really cool shows, I just finished watching The Walking Dead. And have you watched it yet? Oh, I don't want to spoil
not,
it.
Yeah, they're not. I don't think I've seen the last two episodes, so don't spoil
okay.
it.
Okay. One thing.
Good.
I feel like without spoiling it, I can say, don't mess with Michonne and don't mess
no.
with a mom who's trying to protect her kids. That's
yeah.
all you need to know about these yep. these last two episodes on The Walking Dead. Oh my God, I feel
all
so
right.
good watching it. This weekend was good. It was a regular weekend. We did playgrounds. We did picnics and whatnot. We ate at Chick-fil-A. And my husband and I, we have not eaten there in 11 years. I know. But they are building up this South Phoenix area, and they inserted the Chick-fil-A lines for days, all the lines out the
wow.
street from the drive-through, lines out the door from the inside part. It's so popular. And I recall when we ate there for the first time 11 years ago, it was disgusting.
Yeah,
and then after
I never
that,
liked it.
Yeah, we found out that they are hardcore anti-gay and donate mm-hmm. so much money to anti-LGBTQ organizations, pray away the gay organizations. But even some of my liberal friends, liberal people that I follow online and stuff, love it. They fucks with it so hard, saying it's so delicious. And my kids have been dying to go, right? So me and my husband, we were like scratching our heads trying to figure out why everybody loves this trash ass organization and their trash ass food. I mean, literally, it will take you 30 minutes to get through the goddamn drive-thru. Like,
holy
that's
shit.
I don't understand what's going on. So we went in. First of all, the service is outstanding. When is the last time someone told you to have a lovely day? Well, I'll tell you, it was when I ate at Chick-fil-A this weekend. And I don't know if they've like changed their recipes or whatever, but the food is really fucking delicious. I mean, they have a cute little indoor playground, which if you're a mom and you're trying to like do something with your kids and like eat out without having people applaud when you leave the restaurant because your mm-hmm. kids are so loud and obnoxious, you're like, oh God, a play place is great. The activist
yeah.
in me is like wildly ashamed that I ate there. But like the mom in me, is like, that was pretty fucking dope. So the kid, I still hate Chick-fil-A. I hate what they stand for. I don't even think they give, in terms of their health insurance, like they provide an option for birth control for their employees. Like they are
yeah,
so problematic.
Yeah, I think they're one of those. Yeah.
So problematic. But Cuntly, I have two wild ass kids who love chicken tenders, and the food was good, and my kids fell asleep on the ride home, so it was like a godsend. So I don't know. I don't know what to do with Chick-fil-A anymore
yeah,
in my heart or
yeah,
mind. So anyway,
there's always those problems.
Yeah, very problematic. But yeah. I do have to say, they have a play place. Moms who work, it's a good place to get dinner and get your kids tired. Don't support them for all the other bad reasons. Anyway, so now we are going to get into some listener. By the way, do you fucks with Chick-fil-A?
I don't. I okay. refuse to go there. Yeah.
I do too. I mean, there's a lot of places that my kids are like, I want to go here. And I'm like, we can't eat at Papa John's. They're racist. Or
yeah.
like, we shouldn't
yeah.
go to Starbucks. They're racist. You know, like, so there's a lot of places that we're restricting ourselves from going to, or, you know, we haven't watched football. Like, we're trying to
actively like boycott and protest and show that our dollars mean something and people and companies should stand behind, you know, companies that do good and treat people well.
Yes.
And Chick-fil-A isn't one of those companies, but anyway, gotcha. I'm just digging myself into a deeper hole. They got me. So anyway, let's just dive into these listener letters, shall we?
Where's the angels? We need some angels to take away the Chick-fil-A.
I feel better.
Thank right you, now. Angels. I do too.
Thank you, angels. Okay. So we got a very lovely email from Khadija. By the way, also my favorite character on the 1990s Black People prime time hit, Living Single. Did you watch that with Queen Latifah?
I didn't.
Oh, boy. I think you're missing out.
I think it was probably the time when I didn't watch a whole lot of TV when my kids were little.
Oh, well, there was this period in the 90s where there was some fire-ass Black shows. Martin. There was, what's that one? It was like a sketch show. Oh gosh.
Living Color.
And yes, yeah. And Living Single. And woo, I would not miss an episode. So anyway, Khadija, I love you. But she said, hello, dear ladies of Fruit Loops. Thank you for making me proud to be a Podbean patron. Oh my gosh. Thank you, by the way, for being.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being a patron of ours. Stay tuned because we're about to drop our bonus episode for our patrons. So anyway,
it took forever.
Forgive us. Your two-part episode of The Dating Game Killer were awesome. Sorry that the following is an essay, but I had a lot of feelings. So here she goes. As a woman in the Boston area, it meant a lot to me that you'd mention the current case of Jassy Correa on your podcast and that you'd plug the GoFundMe page. If I'm not mistaken, she was a member of Boston Cape Verdean community. FYI, she said she's not a member, which has been victimized by authorities and the general population of Boston racists as being thugs, drug dealers, gang members, etc. Now, welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. Boston has a pretty racist history. Just Google video news reactions of the people who were furious when the authorities forced them to have to segregate their schools. I mean, the things these people said on TV. Whoa. Anyway, she goes on to say it surprised many people that her case even made the news, and many WOCs or women of color like me wonder if it's because there are three states involved in the investigation. The victim was from Massachusetts. The murder may have occurred in Massachusetts. The accused lives in and drove into Boston from Rhode Island, and her body was found in his car in Delaware. We know that many such crimes must be swept under the rug, but I'm glad that the world is forced to hear Jassy's story. Good. She also goes on to say, other women of color, WOCs, I've talked to about this horrible tragedy realized that a huge reason that Jassy could, we can't assume, have been a victim is because of the expectations that men have on women in society, specifically at a club. I'm so glad she brought this point up. It's like if she's at the club, then she must want sex. If she flirts with a dude, it's almost like she must be willing to go home with him, or she's looked at negatively, like she's a tease. And if she and her friends try to make a pact to go together and leave together, her friends are seen as just by men as cock blockers. Men need to change. I don't think men want to accept that as long as they make it difficult for women to say no, they are putting women like Jassy at risk. They need to help themselves and each other rid this toxic idea that women at the club are there purely for men's enjoyment. What if Jassy thought, hey, whatever, he's cute, and denied any weird feeling she had because she didn't want to be a prude? Well, if that's the case, that's awful. So to sum it up, she said, a safety tip I have is to encourage men to cool it at the club. Amen. And act less shitty when a woman doesn't want to go home with them. To create a culture that doesn't allow for men to take advantage of women. Men need to talk to each other and call each other out. The time is now, she says.
Yeah.
All right, ladies, I'm done. I promise. Thank you so much. I love you both. Keep being amazing. XOXO Khadijah. So thank you, Miss Khadijah, for the beautiful, wonderful email.
Yeah.
Yes.
Awesome email.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
So what do you got, Beth?
I just wanted to let our new patrons know that we ran out of stickers.
What a blessing, though, right? I mean, what a blessing to have run out that people want.
Yeah, yeah.
That's dope. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. I have ordered some more, but I'm still waiting to get them. So your packages have been delayed. I do apologize.
Yes, please forgive us, but they're coming and we love you.
But they're coming. They'll get there. They'll get there.
They'll get there. Before we get into our episode, we would like to say that this is a podcast about true crime and people of color. True crime is difficult to hear and talk about sometimes, and race can be the same way. But both are just part of the world that we live in. And we want this to be a safe space where we can have discussions about both. We are all learning all the time and hopefully trying to be our best sexy selves. Me and Beth may not get all the words right. And you at home listening may not get all the words right or say the most 2019 wokest terms. But at least we're trying. So
yeah, and that's okay.
That's okay.
We welcome our listeners to be a part of the conversation on Facebook or Twitter at Fruit Loops Pod, or email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com.
Okay, so now we're going to take a quick break and get into the story when we come back. We would like to invite any listeners who have a business to advertise to do it with us. For more information, please email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com. Or check out our website at fruitloopspod.com. All right, Beth. So, who are we talking about again?
Today, we're talking about the DC sniper attacks, also known as the Beltway sniper attacks. And they were a series of coordinated shootings that occurred during 3 weeks in October of 2002 in the states of Maryland and Virginia and the District of Columbia. 10 people were killed and 3 others were critically wounded in the Baltimore-Washington metropolitan area and along Interstate 95 in Virginia. And we had mentioned more crimes earlier in our intro, and that's because there were some preliminary crimes as well. And I also wanted to say I was talking to my son about this case, and he said that gun people prefer to call these kinds of criminals long-distance serial killers rather than snipers, because sniper is a professional title given with respect, and they deserve none.
Oh, shout out to Beth's son. He's given us some notes before in the past. I mean, like on guns and stuff. I don't know shit, and I really
I know
appreciate
nothing
that he's
about
given
guns.
Us this.
Yeah,
yeah. So I'm just really grateful to your son. I don't know if he listens to the show, but shout out to Beth's son. Thanks for the knowledge. The Fruit Loops fam is happy about that. So let's get into some stats. All right. So February to October in 2002 is when these crimes took place. The DC snipers shot and killed 17 people across the country from Washington State to Arizona to Washington, D.C. The spree in the D.C. area lasted 23 days from October 2nd, 2002 to October 24th, 2002. Everyone who was killed was one bullet. Everybody got one bullet. 10 in the Beltway sniper attacks and 7 in the preliminary shootings. And they used a Bushmaster, I guess it's a type of a gun, and a rifle.
Yep. Yep.
So now we're going to get into the setting. So take it away, Beth.
Montgomery County in Washington, D.C. is a very affluent county in the DMV, which is D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, with very little crime. Obviously, D.C. is our nation's capital, and Alexander Hamilton convinced Washington.
Had a torrid affair, but he wrote it down right there. Highlights!
That's my favorite part.
Okay, sorry.
Damn!
Damn!
Have you read this?
Okay, what?
Anyway. So Hamilton convinced Washington to move the capital from New York to D.C. Washington, D.C. is a compact city on the Potomac River bordering the states of Maryland and Virginia. There's too much history for us to even scratch the surface. The DMV does have a lot of black people, and the reason for that is D.C. is very ethnically diverse. About 47% of the population is black. Washington has had a significant African-American population since the city's creation. Several neighborhoods are noted for their contributions to Black history and culture. Like numerous other border and northern cities in the first half of the 20th century, Washington received many Black migrants from the South in the Great Migration. African Americans moved north for better education and job opportunities, as well as to escape legal segregation and lynchings. Government growth during World War II provided economic opportunities for African Americans, too.
In the post-war era, the percentage of African Americans in the city steadily increased as its total population declined as a result of suburbanization. Supported by federal highway construction and white flight. We've talked about that before. That's when white people left all the neighborhoods because they were afraid black people were going to
flee,
ruin everything.
Flee.
Let's get out of here. The black. Yeah, but you know what? What's interesting is, okay, so there was a great migration of black people moving north.
North,
in
right.
Right, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, even a person like myself, I'm trying to flee racism. And there are people like me who are migrating back to the South. We have family connections there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Family connections there. And those areas where there's so much history for us and some really thick, tight-knit black communities where we can find safety and raise our kids there with good schools, the chance for our kids to have a black teacher in their life for once.
Right.
So there's the opposite, it's trending backwards.
Back.
So younger black people are moving south
back
looking for jobs in places.
Yeah.
Yeah. In places like Atlanta, Houston, Charlotte, North Carolina, Raleigh, those kinds of places. So anyway, tangent. but back then the black population included a strong middle and upper class. John Allen Muhammad, the ringleader in our case, had an intense drive to, we will learn later in the story, kill his ex-wife. So, she ended up, she relocated to the DC area to get away from Muhammad, because she had family ties there. So now we are going to get into the, killer's early life. So take it away, Beth.
John Allen Muhammad was born John Allen Williams in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to Ernest and Eva Williams, the fourth child of a Pullman train porter and an Antiguan immigrant. One of six children, he and his family moved to New Orleans when his mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. She died when he was 3 years old.
Oh, that's really sad.
It is.
Yeah, we will refer to John Allen Muhammad here on out as Muhammad, just to simplify things, but consider how easy it is to refer to him as a terrorist and a criminal because of his color and his last name. Just think about that note. Next time you watch the news. Moving on, after his mother's death, his father left. So Muhammad was mainly raised by his grandfather and an aunt. And it's been alleged that an uncle often beat him. He was described as a polite and well-liked individual.
In August of 1978, Muhammad enlisted in the Louisiana Army National Guard at Baton Rouge as a combat engineer. In 1981, he married his childhood sweetheart, Carol Caglier. In 1982, Muhammad was introduced to Mildred Green by a friend in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Oh, sparks fly.
Mm-hmm.
Mildred was a beautiful young black woman, but she says that she was deeply shy and naive and still lived at home with her mother. Having narrowly escaped being raped at 16, she was also very weary of men. Muhammad, on the other hand, was an outwardly confident National Guardsman with the ability to sweet talk any girl who caught his eye. I think Mildred was also in the service. That's, I believe she said that. I actually heard her interviewed in a podcast. She said that they were both in the service. I also wanted to touch on Muhammad joining the service. And I learned from my Garifuna Central American grandmother's relatives. I was at her funeral around Christmas time. An older Garifuna Central American man, that they specifically chose the USA military for the opportunity and security it provided. Immigrants can join the military in our country. And many U.S.-born people of color and immigrant people of color take advantage of what the U.S. military can offer them. It's an opportunity for a steady job, steady employment, just a better way economically. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Mildred and John Allen Muhammad had been dating for several weeks before she learned that he was still married to his childhood sweetheart, Carol, by whom he had a son. Yeah. And they had a son named Lindbergh. But he assured her that they were on the verge of splitting up. And when he was posted to Washington State to differentiate it from Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's confusing, but it's a whole different state.
It can be.
So she agreed to wait for his divorce to come through and then travel north to join him.
By the way, I my mom still lives in Washington State. I went to high school there. My parents got divorced and then they got remarried to each other and decided to start a new life in Washington State. And basically, I haven't been back there since I graduated high school. And then I returned for my father's funeral. That's how much I hate the Pacific Northwest.
Wow.
I found it to be a very lonely place. It's very, very white. I felt it was very racist. And I actually never forgave Washington State for it. So that's why I just never went back.
So my mom's like,
she's like, Wendy, what are the kids doing this summer? Are they going to come and visit us? Hell no. I love you, Mom. Just come here to Arizona. I'm not taking my kids there. Anyway, where were we? Okay. So they were married in March 1988. As the months and years passed, Mildred discovered her husband was not the contented, self-assured man that she thought him to be. For one thing, he was illiterate. So she had to teach him to read and help him bluff his way through military exams.
In 1991, he served in the Gulf War with a company that dismantled Iraqi chemical warfare rockets. While in the U.S. Army, Muhammad was trained as a mechanic, a truck driver, and a specialist metal worker. He qualified with the Army's standard rifle, the M16, earning the Expert Rifleman's Badge. This rating is the Army's highest of three levels of basic rifle marksmanship for a soldier. So pretty good.
So clearly he was a pretty smart, intelligent,
capable guy.
Skilled, capable guy. He had a varied Army career as a combat engineer, a specialty that involves everything from building roads and removing mines to repairing vehicles and setting up water supplies. A fellow soldier said Muhammad was considered a proficient mechanic, particularly on Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles.
Muhammad was honorably discharged from the Army on April 24th, 1994, after 17 years of service with the rank of sergeant. For his service in the Army, Muhammad received the following awards: Army Service Medal, National Defense Service Medal, Overseas Ribbon, Non-Commissioned Officers Professional Development Ribbon, and Army Achievement Medal. Pretty good.
That's a lot of ribbons. Yeah, that's a lot of awards. Yeah, it's a lot of awards. Neighbors and others who knew Muhammad in the 1990s described him as quiet and a disciplined man, a Muslim convert and auto mechanic who showed no sign of a violent streak. Bob Bianchi lived down the street from the family between 1994 and 2000 in comfortable Huapachio Estates, a community built around a natural lake in Tacoma.
That's Bianchi, the place, huh?
That's one of the places.
One of the places. All right.
Bianchi 47. But actually, Tacoma, I'll tell you one thing. So I was I was my high school's second black varsity cheerleader in a 40 year period.
ever.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm not shy. So the high school I went to was in Spokane. So I was the second black varsity. Spokane, Washington's on the east side, and Tacoma and Seattle are on the west side. And we would go to Tacoma a lot for like cheer competitions. And I remember just my mouth watering because I was so happy to see other black cheerleaders, and they were all from Tacoma and Seattle. And I was like, oh my God, you guys have big butts and big thighs just like me and braids. Oh my God. So maybe if I had lived on the other side of the state, maybe I wouldn't feel so salty about the state of Washington, but sorry, I didn't. So I do. Bianchi 47 called him a very pleasant neighbor who remained kind of private over the years.
Hey, you called me private.
Do I need to be worried? Yeah, Privacy McPriverson's Beth here. Just found out where she lives.
Uh-oh. All right, so Muhammad started up a mobile auto repair business, which he ran with the help of Mildred, who kept the books. And I understand at first they did really well.
Okay.
In addition, he operated a karate school with Felix Strozier. Strozier noticed that whenever Muhammad came into the room, his son, John Jr., would always come to attention military style, which indicated to him that Muhammad was a stern disciplinarian.
Yeah. And well, my dad was a black man from the South, with Southern roots, and a military guy. And he expected us to do the same. So.
Right.
That's not too unusual, but wait,
not
it gets
unusual.
Worse. John Allen and Mildred had converted to Islam together. While Mildred Muhammad saw religion as a means for peaceful social change, her husband was convinced that America's injustices could be overcome only by subversion and violence. In 1987, at the age of 27, he joined the Nation of Islam. In 2001, he changed his surname from Williams to Muhammad.
The Nation of Islam, also referred to as NOI, is an African American movement and organization that combines elements of traditional Islam with Black nationalist ideas and race-based theology. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, an American nonprofit legal advocacy organization specializing in civil rights and public interest litigation, since its founding in 1930, the Nation of Islam, or NOI, has grown into one of the wealthiest and best-known organizations in Black America. Its theology of innate Black superiority over whites and the racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-LGBTQ rhetoric of its leaders have earned the NOI a position in the ranks of organized hate.
Yeah, and I've actually listened to interviews on podcasts of representatives from the Southern Poverty Law Center who say that the only reason, like they don't consider all the other things that the NOI does, just the fact that they
are perceived to hate white people. So that's why they're perceived
Jews
as a hate
group.
And
gays.
And Jews, yeah. Right. Yeah. So they don't. So let me get into it. Okay.
Okay.
Welcome to Culture Corner. Yeah. Welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. Get a pillow. The Nation of Islam, as Beth said, is a black religious group, an American black religious group. We have to remember that Islam is a religion of peace practiced by millions of people. The NOI was started by Elijah Muhammad in the 30s or 40s. And then in the 50s, Malcolm Little, aka Malcolm X, joined. And then let's not forget about Colin Kaepernick's predecessor, Cassius Clay, a.k.a. Muhammad Ali. The face of the group is Louis Farrakhan, and he is quite problematic. I do not disagree with anybody who says that. He is problematic for his positions on patriarchy, anti-Semitism, black superiority over specifically white people. However, we also have to note the work that the NOI has done in trying to stabilize black communities and stabilizing infrastructure, especially in communities that have been ravaged by white supremacy. They have a presence in prison, and their goal is to stabilize and support people within the prisons and also when they get out, giving them jobs and a place to go. They do have a black superiority ideology. They are registered, as Beth said, as a hate group by the SPLC. But to black people, it's really not that simple. Al Sharpton, Jim Brown, and Mr. Farrakhan and Jesse Jackson are the black dudes that are called upon to be the voices of black people in times and places where there was a traumatic event or strife or examples of black oppression. And one of the things that the U.S. has done throughout history is systematically demonizing black groups and black leaders. The most recent one I can think of is Colin Kaepernick, or that right. Waffle House, the dude at Waffle House who saved all those people, who was a black dude. It's easy for the media and authorities to demonize anything black. And so black people understand the critiques of the NOI, but we also understand the good that they have done for black lives. And given how complicated life is as a black person in the United States, can accept the complexities for what they are in a way that maybe white America, aka trash ass Meghan McCain on The View a couple weeks ago towards Tamika Mallory can't understand. So if anybody is not familiar with that exchange, Google Tamika Mallory on The View, and you will see. I mean, Meghan McCain was just like, well, Tamika Mallory was doing she was in charge of the Women's March. And Meghan McCain was trying to say like, well, you're not being very welcoming to conservative women want to be a part of this. And you ride with Louis Farrakhan. And Tamika was trying to explain what I just said. Like, it's really not that simple. Like, I denounce his views on hating anybody, but I also have to recognize that the organization has done a lot of really good things in the black community. And Meghan McCain was just refusing to accept her answer. So allyship can exist between the Nation of Islam, women's groups, Jewish groups, LGBTQ groups, with empathy and solidarity. I really do believe that. Another thing, black people have to compartmentalize all the time. And one of the examples I wanted to lay out to you was D.L. Hughley on a show the other day was asked, you know, how do you continue to listen to Michael Jackson and R. Kelly's music after all the horrible things that they did? And, you know, how can you sing these songs and after all the terrible shit that they did? And he was like, the same way I can sing the fucking national anthem.
Right.
There's different degrees and levels, and we just sort of have to maneuver our way as best we can we're all just trying not to be awful. So black people have to compartmentalize on a constant basis. And the way that black people in general view the NOI is no different. So, I'm so sorry that went so long. But
that's all right. And that's totally fair. I get that. The only issue I have with it is it makes race relations more difficult. You're having somebody who's saying one race is superior to another, either way, there's pretty much no conversation after that, you know. what are you gonna say?
but I think that younger progressives understand that we can have a conversation moving forward on, you know, we can take the good that the NOI has done and we can denounce the bad things that they have done, and we can sort of move the conversation using the good elements forward.
Yeah, I just think it's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate.
I just wish it wasn't part of it.
Yeah, you know what? I agree. I wish that those negative things were not a part of it as well.
Because I was just thinking about like the feminist movement. Feminists, you know, just saying that women are equal to men, like we're not the same, but we should be treated equal. And that you had the militant feminists saying women are better than men. And then all of a sudden feminist became a bad word. It's just, it just doesn't help.
Well, yeah, it doesn't help. But then you also had, Susan B. Anthony, I get excited when I find a Susan B. Anthony coin, but we can't forget that she was super racist. She said no black man is going to get a voting right before a woman. And the black feminists around her were like, hey, sis, like, what about us? And she was like, screw you guys. This is all, let's just get the white ladies first. Okay. So, you know,
life is complicated, is what it boils
really
down
is
to.
Complicated.
Life is complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is no simple answer. And I think a lot of people make the mistake of looking at things in black and white, and it's not black and white. Life is complicated.
It isn't. It's very complicated. So we have to take the good where we can find it, I think. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where were
we? All right. Back into the story. Okay. So, Muhammad had returned from the military with severe PTSD, and this affected his marriage with Mildred. He became abusive, unfaithful, and threatened to kill Mildred regularly. And by the late 1990s, their marriage was falling apart, and Mildred filed for divorce in 1999. When asked later why she didn't leave him sooner, she said that she was simply playing the role to which most Deep South Black girls were raised, that of a dutiful wife.
In February and March of 2000, Mildred filed domestic violence petitions against her estranged husband. A Pierce County judge granted her request for an uncontested permanent restraining order.
She complained of bizarre behavior, such as the morning Muhammad claimed that he had tapped her phones to destroy her. Another day, he forced his way into her house to see his son, John Jr., who was sick, prompting an emergency 911 call. The next day, he returned to the house. John came over to inform me that he will not let me raise our children. His demeanor is such that it is a threat to me, she wrote in a petition for order of protection. I am still fearful of him.
Yeah, she described in the podcast really chilling things, like he would break into her home and then just stand at the foot of her bed watching her sleep. And then she would wake up and he would be like, I'm going to kill you. But then he would leave.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. What?
Yeah.
So on a Sunday in March 2000, Muhammad took the three children for a weekend visit, telling his wife that he would keep them overnight and take them to school in the morning. Instead, he took the children and disappeared, taking $521 from the bank account and borrowing $1,100 from a business partner, leaving Mildred penniless.
Muhammad took his children to Antigua, where his mother was from. He changed the kids' names so that Mildred couldn't find them. There they lived in a hovel without running water, and Muhammad eked out a living by fixing documents for islanders who wanted to migrate illegally to the U.S. He also began a relationship with the mother of Lee Malvo.
So here's our second character, Lee Boyd Malville. His name in formal documents, though he has sometimes been known as John Lee Malville, was born on February 18th, 1985 in Kensington, Jamaica, to Leslie Malville and Una James. He spent his early childhood in Jamaica. A classmate described him as studious, polite, and well-dressed, but said that he did not make any friends. Teachers remember him as a conscientious A-grade pupil.
Around the year 2000, Malvo joined his mother Una James in Antigua, but Una soon left for Florida with Malvo, and Malvo attended Cypress Lake High School in Fort Myers, and Muhammad moved back to Washington with his children.
Meanwhile, Mildred was hiding in a women's refuge, distraught at losing her family and terrified of Muhammad. She continued to fight to find her children and get them back, but it would be 18 months before U.S. authorities traced the children, when Muhammad attempted to claim child welfare in Washington. Now, she went all out. She, like, hired a private investigator.
Wow.
She was working really hard to get these kids back.
Wow. So the children were reunited with their mother, and desperate to start a new life with her family, Mildred fled across the country with her children in September of 2001. She settled near her sister in the Maryland suburbs, just outside of Washington, D.C.
In October of 2001, Malvo left Florida and moved to Bellingham, Washington. To join Muhammad. They lived together at the Lighthouse Mission, a Christian homeless shelter overlooking Puget Sound, about 130 miles north of Tacoma and 20 miles from the Canadian border. Muhammad told people Malville was his son. Malville's biological father, Leslie Malville, a building contractor in Kingston, Jamaica, later called his son a nice kid, though he said he hadn't seen him for 4 years.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, and that kind of tells you what kind of relationship they had.
Right.
Not a very good one.
Nope.
In Bellingham, school officials were concerned that they had no records of Malvo's previous schooling and asked police to check into it. When a Bellingham police officer questioned Malvo on December 18th, Malvo said he was from Jamaica and was living at the shelter with his father. Muhammad was also in trouble for shoplifting, and the two disappeared before police could follow up.
Okay, so now we're going to get into the juicy timeline. So, before the shooting, which have been referred to as the DC sniper attacks, Muhammad and Malvo committed similar crimes across the country that were not linked until way later. These have been referred to as the preliminary crimes, quote unquote.
On February 16th, 2002, 21-year-old Kenya Cook was shot and killed at the front door of her aunt's home in Tacoma, Washington. Cook's aunt, Isla Nichols, had been good friends with John Allen Muhammad's ex-wife, Mildred, and had encouraged her to seek a divorce. There is circumstantial but not ballistic evidence that the killer was Lee Malvo.
On March 19, 2002, Jerry Taylor, 60 years old, was killed by a single shot to the chest fired from long range as he practiced chip shots at a Tucson, Arizona golf course. Muhammad's sister lived near the golf course, and he was visiting her during the shooting.
On August 1st, 2002, John Gaeta, 51, was changing a tire at a parking lot in Hammond, Louisiana, and was shot in the neck. The bullet exited through Gaeta's back, and he pretended to be dead while the shooter stole his wallet. He survived.
Woo! That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, not that he got shot, but that he survived.
He did survive, yeah.
On September, I don't know why I'm laughing. Sorry.
I don't either. inappropriate laughter.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Guilty. On September 5th, 2002, at 10:30 p.m., Paula LaRufa, a 55-year-old pizzeria owner, was shot six times at close range while locking up his Italian restaurant in Clinton, Maryland.
LaRuffa survived the shooting. Wow. And his laptop and computer was found in John Allen Muhammad's car when he and Malvo were arrested.
Wow. On September 11th, Muhammad and another man, Nathaniel Osborne, purchased a blue 1990 Chevrolet Caprice with 147 miles from Sure Shot Auto Sales Incorporated in Trenton, New Jersey. They paid $250 for the car. That is a cheap car.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Shout out to bargain shopping. September 14, 2002, Benny Oberoi, 22, was shot and wounded outside the Hillendale Beer and Wine Store in Silver Spring, Maryland. The shooting is linked by circumstances, witnesses, and location of the alleged snipers, but not ballistics. On September 15th, 2002, Muhammad Rashid was injured in a shooting at a Brandywine, Maryland liquor store.
On September 21st, 2002, at 12:15 a.m., 41-year-old Millian A. Woldemariam was fatally shot in the head and back with a .22 caliber pistol in Atlanta, Georgia. Woldemariam was helping the owner of a Sammy's package store close up for the night when the shooting occurred. Police found a fingerprint on a weapon magazine in the parking lot. I have two things to say here.
Tell me.
First of all, do you know about package stores?
No. I assumed it was like a dollar store or a Walmart.
Nope. On the East Coast, liquor stores are called package stores.
What?
Yeah. When I lived in Connecticut, you had to go to the package store to buy liquor. They did not have liquor in the grocery store. So you had to go to a separate store to buy it, and they were called package stores. I don't know why. We called them packies.
Packies. Wait. So are package stores just liquor stores, or can you get other things there?
Just liquor, alcohol, beer.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's just a liquor store.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. However you do that.
Pretty good. Pretty and good. By the way, I was going to say, I've been doing that at work lately. So shout out to not being professional. But there's this straight edge white dude who I think used to even be a cop who is all about and he watches Blackish. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, I like him.
He was so into it. Yeah, I like him too. Anyway, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
So the first
thing is about the package store. Yeah, they're just liquor stores.
Yeah.
And then the second thing was how police found a fingerprint on a weapon magazine in the parking lot. That's a cartridge for a weapon, right? For the gun.
Yes.
And I read in one article that it was a page from a weapons magazine, like Malvo sitting out there reading a magazine about weapons.
Oh my god. So the publication clearly got it wrong.
Yeah, they're like, what?
He's reading magazines reading and committing crimes.
Yep, that's what he's doing.
What the fuck? Get out of here. You know what?
That was hilarious.
You know what? Get the fuck out of here. My buttons aren't working. Come on. Oh my god. Hang on.
There you go.
Okay. So that's complete that fuckery. On that publication's part.
I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, this has been fun. Okay, so what's next? Oh, here we go. Okay, so 19 hours later, on the same day, Claudine Parker, a 52-year-old liquor store clerk in Montgomery, Alabama, was shot in the chest and killed during a robbery. Her coworker, a 24-year-old Kelly Adams, was critically wounded with a shot through the neck but survived. Oh, yes, amen. Later, ballistics are a match to a Bushmaster .223 rifle, and eyewitness accounts link the DC snipers. There we go. We got them.
We got it. On September 23, 2002, at 6:30 p.m., 45-year-old Hong M. Ballinger was shot in the head. and killed with a Bushmaster rifle in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Muhammad and Malva were later linked to the killing.
So what we see now is the killers are making their way across the United States. Now we are going to get into the DC sniper attack specifically. This is when the authorities realized that they had a killer on the loose. So take it away, Beth.
So the first sniper attack occurred on October 2nd, 2002 at 5:20 p.m. when a shot was fired through the window of a Michael's Craft store in Aspen Hill. The bullet narrowly missed Ann Chapman, a cashier at the store. Since no one was injured, no serious alarms were raised. However, approximately 1 hour later at 6:30 p.m., James Martin, a 55-year-old program analyst at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, was shot and killed in the parking lot of a Shoppers Food Warehouse grocery store in Wheaton.
On the morning of October 3rd, four people were shot dead within a span of approximately 2 hours in Aspen Hill and other nearby areas in Montgomery County. Another was killed that evening in the Tacoma neighborhood of the District of Columbia. Not Tacoma, Washington, but in the neighborhood of District of Columbia.
It's confusing, but yeah.
Just to be clear, yeah. At 7:41 a.m., James L. Buchanan, a 39-year-old landscaper known as Sonny, was shot dead near Rockville, Maryland. Buchanan was shot while moving the grass at the Fitzgerald Auto Mills. Let me see that sentence. Let me see the whole thing again. Okay.
He was moving the grass.
I don't know. Some activities white people do. I don't know.
So I don't know. White people, they're funny.
I don't know. White people are funny. They do weird things. I don't know. My husband, my old whitey's out here like blowing leaves. Why?
He's moving the leaves.
He's moving the leaves, whatever. Okay. Anyway, and digging holes and stuff. I don't know. Anyway. So at 7:41 a.m., James L. Buchanan, a 39-year-old landscaper known as Sonny, was shot dead near Rockville, Maryland. Buchanan was shot while mowing the grass at the Fitzgerald Auto Malls. At 8:12 a.m., 54-year-old part-time taxi driver Prem Kumar Walikar was killed in Aspen Hill in Montgomery County while pumping his gas in his taxi at a mobile station.
At 8:37 p.m., Sarah Ramos, a 34-year-old babysitter and housekeeper, was killed at the Leisure World Shopping Center in Norbeck as she was sitting on a bench reading a book.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. That's sad. At 9:58 a.m., in what was to be the last killing that morning, 25-year-old Lori Ann Lewis Rivera was killed while vacuuming her Dodge Caravan at a Shell station in Kensington, Maryland.
Oh, no.
Yeah, these are all sad.
Yeah, very much so.
The snipers then waited until 9:20 p.m. before shooting Pascal Charlotte, a 72-year-old retired carpenter, while he was walking on Georgia Avenue at Kalmia Road in Washington, D.C. Charlotte died less than an hour later.
In each shooting, the victims were killed by a single bullet fired from the same distance, and in each case, the killer struck and then vanished. Fear quickly spread throughout the region as news of the shooting spread. Local residents, frightened by the seemingly random nature of the shootings, which crossed racial, gender, and even, we'll learn, age, because they shot a 13-year-old boy who lived, which was good, and socioeconomic lines, crouched behind their cars while pumping gas and avoided outdoor activities. So schools held recess indoors and sports teams canceled outdoor practices.
The killers also left a series of cryptic clues at crime scenes, including tarot cards and notes, and they even called the police hotline, apparently trying to engage investigators in a dialogue.
Yeah, but they hung up on them. So that is where we're going to leave it today. That's the end of it for this episode. Tune in next week for the rest of the story. So now we're going to get into how not to get schmurdered. So
If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
Hey. Oh, I like it.
Doing drugs. I'm just kidding. I'm done.
Sorry. This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. But in my mind, this is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips. What do you got, Wendy?
Okay, so this is a full lineup of tips. So please get your pencils out. Keep your head on a swivel. Pay attention to the news. If authorities are out here saying it's not safe to be out, don't be out. Listen to them. Identify safe havens you can retreat to in the event of a terror attack. That's just something I
always unfortunately keep it in the back of your mind.
Thinking about. Yeah. Be aware of where police stations are, hotels, hospitals, places where you can go in the event that you need to get a good night's rest, in the event you need to evacuate or contact authorities or seek medical care wherever you are, on vacation or at home. Use caution around religious holidays. Many religiously motivated terrorists schedule large attacks to coincide with their religious holidays. So exercise, I got this from the internet. So this is not coming from me. This is just a tip I found. Exercise extra vigilance during these times. And if possible, avoid public areas. Again, if possible. And keep an eye out for shifty people. Lastly, I have a theory about saving the world, and I'm going to do it in this podcast. Be kind and treat people with dignity. Don't hate on people who speak a different language or who have a different skin color, accent, or religion, or dress differently than you. I heard on one podcast about the conflict in the Middle East recently that mentioned that every single time they engage in these peace talks, they always failed. And the reason was because the agreements lacked an element of dignity for each side. So it's probably oversimplifying, could be, but what would happen to the bully who was showed love in high school, or the Muslim kid who you decided to sit with at lunch one day because nobody else wanted to because they were afraid or didn't know any better? There's power in kindness, love, and dignity. That's something serial killers are not shown in their younger days or adult lives. And we know what happens. So,
yeah. Yeah. So building off of that, there's an article that was written last year about what to do if you witness Islamophobic harassment. And I think it applies to harassment of anyone. And this is not a tip of how not to get murdered, but how to help other people not get murdered.
Oh, yes. Let's do it.
So they're talking about verbal harassment. If someone is physically attacking another person, call 911. Or as my daughter says, call 911 Whizzle. this strategy is based on something called non-complementary behavior, a concept in psychology which aims to disrupt an oppressive connection a potential attacker is attempting to establish with the target. We'll link the article in the show notes, but here are the basic guidelines. So talk to the victim, ignore the attacker. Basically, go over to the victim, sit down and start talking. Talk about something random, like, did you see the Transformers movie, or, you know, whatever you can think of. I like your scarf, you know, whatever you can think of.
Yeah, yeah.
Just something random.
When are
just
we getting
engage.
Our nails done together?
Yes. Just start engaging them in conversation. Continue to engage the person in conversation. Building a safe space as you ignore the attacker. Do not talk to the attacker because once you engage with the attacker, it's just going to escalate. So just talk to the person who's being attacked, like you're just having a conversation. Stay with them until the attacker leaves, and then escort them to a neutral area.
I love this tip. There not too long ago was an incident on, I believe, a train where a white nationalist hate mongrel attacked he ended up killing these women of color.
Oh my God.
I think they were in hijab. He had a knife. He had weapons. So it might have been really difficult for somebody to step in
to just
because of
like
fear,
that.
Right? Of getting hurt. Yeah, to do something like that. But in the event there maybe are no weapons, I really like these tips. I also think this is something we could teach maybe our kids to do.
Yeah,
like if you see somebody bullied,
just go up to sit by them and start talking.
Yeah. Hey, bro, you cool? You want my peanut butter and jelly? Oh, turns out I got two pieces. You know what? I don't know. I just think this is something we need to exercise and continue to exercise. Especially, you're right. This was a great tip.
Yeah.
Thank you, Beth.
Yeah.
Thank you. So now we're going to get into some serial killer and crime news. Take it away, Beth.
So the crime news that I have today, I touched on a little bit earlier, the college admissions bribery scandal. So this might seem like just a goofy story, and we all feel a little schadenfreude at seeing these rich people getting arrested. But it really illustrates the deep racial and economic disparities in our country.
Boy, does it ever.
Yeah. And there are people of color getting jail time just for listing a relative's address as their own to get their kids into a decent public school so that they can get a basic education.
Amen.
And here's these rich, mostly white folks bribing their kids' way into Ivy League colleges. I don't know for sure, but I bet they will get very little, if any, jail time. It's infuriating.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
My inner black Tyrone is furious.
Anyway, there's an episode on The Daily, which is a New York Times podcast on this story, and it's really good. They talk about all the implications, and I don't think they talked about the aspect that there are parents who are in jail for listing their relative's address as their own. I don't think they got into that, but they talk about.
They did not. I listened to the Daily. They did not mention that.
Yeah, they didn't mention that, but they talked about why these parents did this, and they talked about the disparities, and it was pretty good. It didn't cover everything, but it was pretty good. So we'll link that in the show notes.
We will. If you do want to know more about this mother, these kinds of black mothers' stories who used the fake addresses in order to get their kids to go to a well-performing school.
Which is really common. People do it all the fucking time.
People do it all the time.
White people do it too.
Yeah. Yes. Everybody does it because don't we all? We all want the best for.
We just want our kids to have a good education.
What we kind of have in common with rich people is we all do want the best for our kids. It's just we don't always get the we don't have the same means to go about it.
Yeah.
So we have to just do the best with what we got. There is a documentary about lying. And it's on Netflix. I want to say it's Why We Lie or The History of Lying. It might be a Freakonomics documentary. Uh-huh. I'm going to figure it out. And then I'll link it in the show notes. But they interview one of these moms who did, I think she did 5 years in federal prison for
The
fake address thing to get her kids into a better school.
That is such bullshit. It's infuriating.
Yeah. It is. The documentary's angle is about what people, how people lie and why people lie. So it doesn't really get into the race thing very much, or the college scandal at all. But, I think it's worth looking at. I mean, I was aware of this happening before the news story broke. This is not the first time that people have committed fraud in order to get their kids ahead.
Yeah.
And I, I am just looking forward to see if justice will be weighted equally towards
it won't.
Felicity Huffman and Aunt Becky. It won't. I know it won't, but
just
maybe,
interested to see what happens. Yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah, there's also somebody shared in our Facebook group a homeless Black woman who wanted her kids to go to any school and just used an address, I think, of a business or something. And she went to jail too.
Holy shit.
So, you know, things aren't looking so great. Betsy DeVos, where you at? Are you going to help us out with this?
No, she's not. She don't give a shit.
She might be busy doing other things. I don't know. But anybody who knows Betsy DeVos, maybe ask her what she thinks.
She's promoting
about
charter schools.
You know, but look, I can't hate on charter schools either, because as a I'm going to say maybe middle class. I'm not poor. I'm not destitute. We's all right over here in the Wendy Williams house. We's are going to be all right. But my kids do go to a charter school because the school up the street is very low performing.
Yeah.
And now, so we're sort of.
Well, do you know why it's low performing?
Yes.
Because there's so many damn charter schools.
There's so many charter schools.
And that's where the money goes.
That's where the money goes. But the charter school thing felt really good when we first started it, but it doesn't feel very good anymore. We're actually going to take our kids out of this school. Because remember, I think I told you my kid was called the N-word.
Yep.
And we gave them all these resources to try to like turn this into
a learning opportunity. And they didn't do anything.
Nobody has done anything.
Not surprised.
And then my kid keeps getting into trouble. And I've talked about this before. Kids of color in general, especially when they have a white teacher, anything that they do is like
they get in trouble for.
Perceived as violent or improper behavior.
Troublemakers.
My son gets in trouble a lot and it drives me fucking nuts. And so we are going to, our plan is to get my kids out of this charter school that we thought was so great in the beginning and send them to the public school that's in our neighborhood. Now, the reason why I'm comfortable with this is we have the resources so that if education wise, my son may not be getting all of what he needs in this public school that we're paying taxes for. We have the resources. We pay for tutoring 2 hours a day, 4 days a week for him. So we have the means to get him the extra resources so that he can succeed. And eventually all of the resources we're throwing at him will benefit the school and the kids around him. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, charter schools make me mad too.
Like, just like the Chick-fil-A thing, it's complicated. Yeah.
Just like the Chick-fil-A, it's complicated. So,
yeah.
Anyway, hashtag Chick-fil-A. So now we're going to move into the part of our show where we shout out any content by people of color, any marginalized groups, LGBTQ people, people of color, or any true crime goodies. So you go ahead, Beth.
So I'm just going to shout out an article that I read recently called How Inuit Parents Teach Kids to Control Their Anger. I'm always interested in how other cultures do things because I believe that we can always learn new things from them, other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So anyway, Inuits don't use corporal punishment. They don't use timeouts or scolding. None of that.
What?
Yeah. They have a philosophy that when a child is acting out, they're upset about something and it's up to you to figure out what it is. And when you yell at children, you're just teaching them to be angry. And also they feel like when you're yelling, you're acting like a child. You're being very childish.
Okay.
And also parents who control their own anger are helping their children learn to do the same because kids learn emotional regulation from us, their parents. So Inuits use storytelling to keep their kids in line. Reading the article, I don't know about the stories they tell because they seem kind of scary about monsters in the ocean and stuff. Ah!
Oh, God.
But I did do something similar with my kids, although I can't say I didn't yell and that I didn't lose my temper right. because yeah. I did.
It's difficult. You're a single mom. Come on. Yeah. Come on. You did the damn thing, okay?
But I did tell them what could happen if they did something. Like if you run into the street, you might get hit by a car, that kind of thing. Just relaying possible uh-huh. consequences of their actions so that they can understand rather than just telling them they can't do something or punishing them for disobeying when without telling them why. And I think that's what they're getting at in the article was
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I do that with my kids. Like if my kids want to meet a new dog that they haven't met before or they don't know, I will say, would you like to see pictures of what happens to a kid's face on Google Images if they meet a dog that they don't know? Or would you like to see images of a skin disease if you touch something that you shouldn't or don't wash your hands? Or would you like to see images? Like Google Images is like the annual
parenting. It's a nightmare, man. It's a nightmare for yeah. sure.
And my kids, they always say no, and then they'd be good. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just knowing what the consequences could be, you know, just understanding that there's consequences to everything that you
right.
do. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to see a video? I could go on. Like, there's
on
no point in getting
on.
Mad. Do you want to see the Google video? I'll just show you right now.
So there was also a recent This American Life episode called Unconditional Love. One of the segments was about a kid who was adopted from a Romanian orphanage, and it was about the difficulties that the family had in dealing with this kid because he had an attachment disorder. Basically, both of these stories talked a lot about giving children love and how love helps kids form healthy emotional lives. And we talk a lot about serial killers and how they're deeply flawed human beings with anger and other emotional issues. So I thought it applied.
Yeah.
Basically, give your kids lots of love, folks. And that's it.
Thank you so much, Beth. You know what? Wait a minute. What's that?
Yes. Give your kids lots of love.
Yeah, lots of love. Lots of love. So thank you, Beth. That was an awesome rec. Thank you so much. So, hey, guys, it's been fun. But where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod, and links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash app, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help.
That is correct. This is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.